Your next speaker is Avon Malone.
Every day you are the recipient of a great bounty. And that's true in many senses and in many areas of your life. That's reflected in many blessings, but I have one in particular in mind. Every day you're given 86,400 seconds to live. 24 hours each day, each of them filled with 60 minutes. And this is one of your most crucial and critical areas of stewardship. A gift from God, unmarred, unsullied, unsoiled. Fresh from His hand it comes to you, bright with opportunity, filled and fraught with great potential. God's gift to you daily. And yet most of us have some time troubles, some problems with the time we have. And we want to talk about time troubles. We want to talk about some truth about time. We want to talk about how to triumph over time and over these time troubles. I think a lot of our time troubles could be very briefly summarized. As I heard one fellow express it recently, we spend a lot of our time either futurizing or pasteurizing. We're either anticipating what's coming in the future, maybe anticipating it with apprehension, worry or dread, anxiety, or maybe with a high sense of expectancy that dulls the present moment. But at any rate, we're futurizing or we're pasteurizing. We're caught up in the good old days complex, or maybe tragically we're paralyzed in the present because of past mistakes and failures. It is crucial, of course, that we learn to overcome these time problems and live in the present. With regard to the tendency to look to the future and live in the future, I'm reminded of the language of James in James chapter 4 at verse 13. Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we'll go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. And James goes on, you know not what you'll be on the morrow, or what is your life, it's even a vapor. Incidentally, James is not here teaching against planning. He's not teaching against planning, against looking to the future and planning. You know what he's teaching against? Presumptuous planning that leaves God out. And we may say more about that. James says we ought to say, if the Lord wills, we'll do this or that. I believe we ought to say it. It's in that context that he said, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it's sin. James 4:17. And he says that in the particular context of the discussion of planning that leaves God out. But if I might borrow the language of James, a lot of us live our lives saying, today or tomorrow we're going to do something. And in the process of that, some of us miss the magic of the moment and we fail to live in the present. A lot of us really try to postpone living. And so life becomes to us long, dreary tedium. Boring and tedious hours, punctuated and broken only occasionally by those fleeting moments in which we really live. God never intended that it be that way. And God never intended that we view the future either with great dread or an apprehension or with that kind of anticipation that takes the relish off the present. The youngster's always waiting till I can get my driver's license, or I can get my first job, or I can get this, or I can get that, or the other. And so life goes on in those stages, and there's always something out there, not really living right now, but out there it's going to get better. The book says live now. There's really one word on the calendar of God, and His call to repentance is always now. And the word is now or today in the word. And we'll notice that as we go on in this study. There's also the problem of the past. Either it's looking back with such fondness to the past that we can't live now, or looking back with such a sense of failure and regret and remorse that the past becomes such a heavy albatross we cannot live productively in the present. And the great and well-known statement of Paul in Philippians 3 would well apply. He uses here the metaphor or the figure of the runner engaged in the contest, one of those Grecian games, one of those races familiar to Paul. And Paul said, "Brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things that are behind." In the context of Philippians 3, that included some things in which at one time he might have gloried. He's now learned better. But he talks about pride of ancestry and pride of orthodoxy and pride of activity and pride of morality, circumcised the eighth day, of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, the Hebrew of Hebrews, concerning the law of Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning the righteousness which is in the law found blameless. Some of that, a painful memory from the present vantage point, persecuting the church. Some of it, things in which at one time he might have gloried. Listen, whether it's that which might cause you to rest upon your laurels and level off at your present spiritual development and try to coast on in, or whether it's the dread recollection of a past mistake, the Word is saying forget it. Paul is saying forgetting the things that are behind. Now, obviously, with regard to sin, you're not going to forget it unless you meet the Lord's conditions that He might forget it. The Hebrews writer in Hebrews 8:12 uses the language of Jeremiah chapter 31, a great promise that God makes to those who come under the cover of the cross. "I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more." God forgives, God forgets. On the Day of Atonement, over the head of the scapegoat, the sins of the people were confessed, and then that animal was led out into the wilderness. Jesus, our sin bearer, our scapegoat, bears the burden of our guilt into the wilderness of God's forgetfulness. But that great benefit and blessing comes conditionally on the condition of our obedient trust, on the condition of our faith, on the condition of our penitence, on the condition of that faith expressed in obedience. And that then enables us, for all practical purposes, to forget. The recollection that Paul had persecuted the church is not totally eradicated from his faculty of memory, but for all practical purposes, that's forgotten. You know, there's a saying among Navy people, long time ago, and a brother, by the way, of Brother Jim Elkins, was there some during that time, but a long, long time ago, I preached in Waukegan, Illinois, for a period of a little over 4 years. We were close to Great Lakes Naval Training Center. And among Navy people, there's a saying, the two best places on earth are the place we were before we were sent here and the place we're going when we finally get to leave here. Two best places on earth. And some people live out life like that, and they postpone living, and they miss it all. The Word teaches against that. We've talked a little bit about time problems. Let's talk about some truth about time. Number one, it's very short. Life is brief. Look again at the James passage, James chapter 4. What is your life? It's even a vapor that appeareth for a little while and then vanisheth away. Fitting figure. Here's the mist, here's the fog, here's the vapor. Doesn't last very long. Unless it's on your windshield on some mornings, then it seems like it lasts a little longer. Truth about the matter is, the mist on the mirror, the vapor is very, very fleeting, and life is like that. A vapor-like existence. The figure in Job is like a weaver's shuttle. Man born of a woman is a few days and full of trouble, Job tells us. And so throughout the Word, there are figures and metaphors suggestive of the brevity of life. 1 Peter chapter 1, at verse 24, quoting from Isaiah 40, "All flesh is as grass, and the glory of man is the flower of grass. The grass withereth, the flower thereof fadeth away, but he that doeth the will of the Lord abideth forever." What's human life like? It's brief. What's time like? It's fleeting. Your life is a vapor. All flesh is as grass, the glory of man as the flower of grass. The grass withereth, the flower thereof fadeth away. One poet put it like this, the boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave away to lack the inevitable hour, the paths of glory lead but to the grave. The truth about time is short, and life is fleeting. In addition to that, time will end. Remember when they came upon that blind man in John chapter 9? And the disciples wanted to go into some kind of theological discussion as to who was responsible for this man's sin or his parents. And Jesus said, neither. And then in that context, John 9:4, we must work the works of Him that sent me while it's day. For the night cometh when no man can work. Time will end. The night cometh when no man can work. John chapter 9 at verse 4. Time will be no more is the way some translators have translated a very expressive phrase in Revelation 10:6. Time will be no longer. So life is brief and time is short and time will end. And there are some things that time will place irretrievably beyond our reach. When that infant, the offspring of David, died, the great king who had been in mourning while he yet lived washed himself. His attitude changed and he said, "He cannot come to me, but I will go to him." There are some things that time changes irretrievably, irrevocably. That's really the truth about time. And therefore, there's a responsibility that rests upon us. Ephesians chapter 5 at verse 16. Let me back up one verse. Walk circumspectly. The King James translates it. Walk carefully. Not as wise, but as unwise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. So, exercise your stewardship of time, that in the power of God, time might be bought back in a sense, redeemed, well used. The old statement, the old adage we've all heard, time is money, understates the case. Time is that inexplicable raw material without which nothing in this life is possible. It is the very stuff of which life is made. Benjamin Franklin said, if you value life, don't squander time, for that's the stuff life's made of. To say then that time is money is not adequate, and that understates the case. Every day, lo, you awake, and you receive from the hand of God 24 hours of time. It can't be stolen. It's unstealable. It cannot be taken from you. We talk about equality. Here is one area in which there is absolute equality. Genius or wealth will not add another hour to the day for anyone. Everyone has just as much as anyone else. If in terms of financial budgeting, you find that expenditures are exceeding income, then you can either work to earn a little bit more, or you can brace the muscles and bite the bullet, and you can exercise some control and balance the budget. But with regard to time, everybody receives exactly and precisely the same amount. It's a kind of wonder. Day after day, God gives it. And you can't waste it in advance. It can be wasted. But again, the day comes and you have that time, and yet one time will be no more. And most of us, I think, have the feeling that somehow it's slipping away and our life is still really not in order. Oliver Wendell Holmes, the great jurist, said, "All my life it seems that I've been stringing and unstringing my instrument, and the music of my heart is still within me." Somehow or another, we have the uneasy feeling that time ebbs away, this marvelous gift from God, and we've not appropriated it as we should. And that leads me to talk for a few moments about triumph in time and a triumph over time problems. And I think one of the first things necessary here is the calm realization of the extreme difficulty of the task that's ours. I am very much mistaken if I think it's going to be easy to really be a good steward of time. It's not going to be easy. And at the very outset, I need to recognize that. That it's not going to be an easy thing to use this great gift from God wisely. And right here, let me just kind of inject something parenthetically. We're not trying to say that we're to be so time conscious that we do not have time to be available, that we do not have time for people. I'm not saying that. There were some doctors that collaborated in the writing of the book about the type A personality. And one of the characteristics that they noted about the type A personality was what they called hurry sickness and a great tendency to continually watch the watch. In fact, they had a friend who did that habitually, and so they tried something on him. Right after they looked at it, they asked him, "What time is it?" And he couldn't tell them. He didn't know. He just got through looking at his watch, but that had become habitual. I'm not talking about a kind of time consciousness in which we're tyrannized by this tendency to continually look at the watch or whatever. Not that. We have some clock-eyed brethren, and I would kind of discourage that, I guess. You may have heard about a fellow who came to a lady making a request of her husband, a very important matter. Crucial issues were at stake. Can he do this at 8 o'clock? She says, "Oh no, that's out of the question. He always walks the dog at 8 o'clock. Well, I'm not talking about a kind of tyranny to a rigid schedule that becomes a rack of torture. The other extreme, though, is the squandering of time and allowing life to ebb away with our music still in us, never having really lived as we ought. And so I think we began by the calm realization of the difficulty of the task. Now, what are some practical points? Number one, value time and plan to use it wisely. I suppose with regard to this point, if there were any one text that I would impress upon your mind, it's Psalms 90, verse 12. "So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom." It seems to me the psalmist is making the petition and expressing the desire that we will learn to so value time and to so appreciate this precious gift that we will apply our hearts to wisdom, particularly in the area of the stewardship of time. Hear again the words of Jesus on this point. "We must work the works of Him that sent me while it's day, for the night cometh when no man can work. So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom." Some of us drip like the derelict, so to speak, with regard to the use of our time because we haven't really planned to use it wisely. And I know from experience, and you know from experience, that unless we do some of that, the tyranny of the urgent, this has got to be taken care of today, this letter's got to be done today, this call has got to be returned today, and so the tyranny of the apparently urgent will drive out that which is really more important. And at the end of the day, it could be said of us, "Busy man, you've had a little day." You know, we say to the little fellow, "Little man, you've had a busy day." Well, little man, you've had a busy day. A busy day, but the time has not been very well used. Eldon Trueblood, in his book, The Yoke of Christ, had a chapter he called The Discipline of Discipleship. And he tells about a particular group of people, essentially a religious fellowship, who practiced what they call the plotted day. The plotted day. And in that plotted day, there was time set aside for prayer. There was time set aside to pray to God, to commune with the Almighty spiritually in prayer, in the reading of His Word. Time was set aside for other necessary responsibilities and priorities of major importance had time allotted to them, and they weren't crowded out by the apparently urgent. The plotted day and then the prayers of the evening, the previous day, prayed with regard to that plotted day, were expressed in view of that plotted day. We need to plan the way we're going to use our time. I heard about a farmer one time with some very unruly mules. Didn't rain very well. And he was tugging on the reins and hollering gee and haw without very much good effect. And he said, "Well, just go anywhere you please. The whole field needs to be plowed." And that's kind of the way some of us do with the use of our time. And that's self-defeating. We need to value it and plan to use it wisely. Now, this is not going to come as any surprise. We need to live in day-tight compartments. I'm not really sure. I think maybe it was Carnegie. I'm not sure about that. Who paraphrased Jesus in this way. Let's see what Jesus said. "Be not anxious for the morrow, Matthew chapter 6, verse 34. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. The morrow shall take heed unto itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Jesus is saying, live one day at a time. Live in daytight compartments. Don't be paralyzed today because of apprehension about tomorrow. Don't be anxious about tomorrow. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Live in daytight compartments. But let's sharpen that point a little bit and say this. Practice the power of the present moment. Practice the power of the present moment. Over at OCC, we've got a grand tradition. We have a whole week of preschool meetings before school starts. And that enables the teachers to sympathize with students who get tired of sitting a long time and listening to lectures and panels and questions and things like that. It's a wonderful exercise. We just enjoy it immensely. And in the midst of those preschool meetings, we got to watch a videotape. And this educator and lecturer got up there. This was introduced with a little bit of an apology, and after we saw it, we began to understand it. There was a long build-up of about 20 or 30 minutes, so much build-up that no matter what he said, it was going to be anticlimactic. He could have made the most profound statement in the world, and it would have seemed anticlimactic. And after all this build-up, he'd get right on the verge of it and then go into something else. And finally, he got to it. Here it is. Do what you're doing when you're doing it. Oh, me. Can you imagine sedate, dignified college teachers kind of getting amused, you know? Do what you're doing when you're doing it. Be where you are when you're there. Hey, listen, he actually said something very profound. I've got to admit that I was like some of the others. For one thing, I was worn out. I was also a little bit amused by all this introduction and prelude. But really what he's saying is very, very profound. Do what you're doing when you're doing it. Lots of us live out life and never do that. Here we are, but we're not really here. We're off on some mental excursion. There's Monday morning's business transaction that's occupying our mind. Wouldn't we be embarrassed if all these excursions flashed on the screen? Be where you are when you're there. Do what you're doing when you're doing it. Hey, that's profoundly true. Toscanini, the great musician, said that living the present moment, doing your best in the present moment, that really is the great duty of life. That's the difference between great living and vegetating. The magic of the moment. And so when the person does his best, and you watch, say, an Edberg maybe, or a Becker, or somebody else, a Lindell, and you wonder how he does as well as he does, well, he's forgotten about the last game, and the last set, and the last point. And he's very much involved in the present moment. And if that changes, then his game is going to go down in a great big hurry. And so we're preoccupied sometimes when confronted by people of all the tragic things that there could possibly be. Fellow travelers in this journey to eternity. But we're so concerned about what we're going to do over there or what happened back there that we miss the moment. We need to learn to practice the power of the present moment and live now. That's the only way we can really live. James Russell Lowell said, life is a sheet of paper white upon which each of us may write his line or two. And then comes night. Greatly began. Though thou hast time for but a line, be that sublime. Not failure, but low aim is crime. Seize the present moment. Life, the sheet of paper white, comes to you with all its potential. Unsullied, unsoiled. But you'll not make the best of it unless you learn to live now, right now. That's the word that's stressed on heaven's calendar and upon many pages of this word. Remember, now thy Creator, in the days of thy youth, Ecclesiastes 12:1. Today, if you hear His voice, harden not your heart. Hebrews 4:7. Now is the accepted time. Now, today's the day of salvation. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 at verse 2. Let me make another suggestion. In the use of time, though all of it is valuable, we need to realize that a stewardship of time demands an awareness of what is timely. In the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son, Galatians 4:4. Everything was right. The very time was ripe The Roman peace prevailed throughout much of the world. The Roman road spanned much of the world. The common Koine Greek was the universal language. The law had been a schoolmaster, a little child leader for 1,500 years. Everything was right. In the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law. Mordecai comes to Esther. The Jewish nation is facing a crisis. Esther can be God's instrument in the hand of God to help to deliver them and spare them. And Mordecai suggests, perhaps you've come to the kingdom for just such a time as this. Years ago, the then existent Fort Worth Christian College had a series of lectures with that theme. Such a time as this. We need to be aware of the fact that there are some times that are so crucial in the life of that youngster in your home. As you work with that individual that you want to lead to Christ, and because of that, all of these things that press upon us that may someday seem so important are unimportant when that time comes. I'm pretty ashamed of myself recently. I was asleep one Saturday afternoon about a week ago, and sometimes when I wake up from sleep, I'm not even coherent for a while. And I can't get my between-the-ear muscles to function. And a friend that I'd known from boyhood called me with a very urgent appeal. And my first reaction was, if you can't get somebody else to take care of that, well, I'll do it. Boy, was I ashamed of myself when I finally got awake. When I finally understood what I'd said. We need to have a sense of what's timely. Shakespeare said, there is a tide in the affairs of men which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. And the quotation goes on to say, but if you fail to seize it then, you are fated then to live your days in the shallows. And when we plan, individually, congregationally, we need to take that into account. One other thing I'd like to say with regard to the stewardship of time. We need to use our time. I've already really touched on this, but let me say a bit more and really try to make it clear. We need to use our time with a view to the great priorities. To those priorities that are most important. A very ambitious lad, very ambitious young man, was talking to an older man. And the young man said, I plan to learn a trade. The older man said, what then? And then? The young man said, and then I want to set up in business. And then, the older man asked, well, I want then to make my fortune. And then, well, I'll grow older and retire and live on my money. And then, well, I suppose someday I'll die. And then, the last stabbing question. And then, if your stewardship of time takes into account only one world and not two, you've missed out on the important priority. So teach us to number our days that we may attune our heart to wisdom. Time is important because it's the proving ground for eternity. And we live with people in our day who have thrown away eternity so that they might be free to kill time. But we can't be free to kill time because there is eternity out there. And we need to use our time with a view to the higher priorities. What time is it? What time is it? Well, that depends on where you are. If you're on the East Coast, it can be 8 o'clock. At the same time, 7 p.m. in Chicago. 6 p.m. in Denver. 5 p.m. in San Francisco. What time is it? It depends on where you are. Somebody imagine the lifespan of 70 years as the face of a clock. If you're 15 years old, it's 8:51. If you're 20... it's 11:08. If you're 30, it's 1:25 p.m., 1:25 in the afternoon. If you're 40, it's 4:15. If you're 50, it's 6:50. If you're 60, it's 9:24. If you're almost 70, it's almost midnight. What time is it? On her deathbed, facing an unending eternity, Queen Elizabeth cried out, "Oh, my millions, for an inch of time, I'd give it all up. I'd cast my crown in the dust. I'd give up my immense fortune for an inch of time, an unending eternity, a gaping eternity staring before her." And all of that impressing upon her the need to seize time, and it was then too late. All my millions for an inch of time. We're about to sing the song, Bring Christ Your Broken Life, So Marred by Sin. He will create anew, make whole again. Listen to this. Your empty, wasted years He will restore, and your iniquities remember no more. In the book of Joel, there was a terrible locust plague. And in Joel 2:25, God said, I will restore unto you the years that the locust destroyed. Somehow, God has a way of being able to do that. Bring Christ your broken life, so marred by sin. He will create anew, make whole again. Your empty, wasted years, He will restore. And your iniquities, remember no more. Repent. When? On the calendar of God, it's now. Believe with all your heart that Jesus is the Christ. When? Today. The only day on God's calendar.